There is a crisis at hand, and there's something you can do about it. Next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis of the Institute for Principled Policy. Today's program is a compilation of previous programs on the topic of Ohio's attempt to pass a resolution calling for a so-called Federal Amendments Convention. We are doing this today because the Ohio legislature is once again using the same flawed arguments in an attempt to pass this dangerous resolution. We are urging you to listen to the program today and the programs we did earlier this week, which are available at www.principledpolicy.com. Then contact your state representative and state senator to oppose HJR 3. That's House Joint Resolution 3. It's simple and easy, and two phone calls or two letters or two emails may preserve your liberty.
When can balancing a budget cause you to lose your liberty? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And with me, as usual, is my Vice Chairman, cohort, and radio co-host, Chuck Michaelis.
And great to be with you here today, Barry. We're going to be discussing a very interesting topic.
Yes, we are. You know, the teaser up front, I was very serious. There's a time that when balancing a budget can cause us all to lose our liberty. You see, I'm talking about a piece of legislation. Actually, it's a resolution that has been put forth by our Ohio State Senate. This resolution, Senate Joint Resolution 2, SJR 2, is a very small document. It's only two and a little bit of a tag on the third page pages. And it was introduced recently by Senator Bill Coley of the Butler County area in southwest Ohio, and has five co-sponsors, all Republican members of the Ohio Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, and all, by and large, considered very conservative members of that body. However, the document that they've issued for consideration by the Senate and then possibly by the House and possibly then put into action by our General Assembly is anything but conservative. As a matter of fact, it may be one of the most progressive pieces, unintentionally, that the legislature has seen in a number of years. What am I talking about? What does Senate Joint Resolution Number 2 do? Senate Joint Resolution Number 2 will apply to the United States Congress to call for a constitutional convention of the states to propose amendments to our Constitution.
Let's kind of lasso it in just for a second, and that is the proponents of this thing will say that they're calling a convention specifically for amendments only.
Well, and if you look at the language now, and that's the reason why I want people to understand this. If you look at the language of what's being put out there, it looks like the parameters have been set clearly. It's very limited. There are checks on things that could happen, limiting delegates. Because honestly, what it is, okay, look, folks, I guess let's unpack this a little bit more. Let's go back to our United States Constitution, because that's where the genesis of this comes from. The genesis of this is in Article 5 of the United States Constitution, which is the article which sets up the process for amending the Constitution that was given to us by our founders in 1787. We're going to get into more deeply what specifically Article 5 says, but ultimately one of the ways or amendments can be added to the document is by two-thirds of the states calling for a constitutional convention for the purpose of amending the document. So two-thirds of the states, for those of you who are in your car and can't grab a calculator real quick, we have 50 states. Two-thirds would be 34 states. So 34 of the 50 states would do the same thing that Ohio is planning on doing here, where they put a resolution before the body of the state legislature and say, we would like to direct Congress to call a constitutional convention for the purpose of amending. Now, Ohio's call specifically spells out the rationale for why they think they're doing this. And I'll just read it here straight from the horse's mouth. And I'm not calling Bill Coley a horse, okay? But it says, whereas with each passing year, this nation becomes more deeply in debt. We all agree with that. As its expenditures exceed available revenues. See, that's the whole, now we're getting into this budget thing. And whereas fiscal prudence requires that certain steps be taken to control the growth of the budget and eliminate excessive deficits. That's the rationale for why they're taking this action, okay? They're seeing the condition of our country. They're seeing our economy in meltdown. They're seeing our Congress and our executive branch spending money faster than it can be printed. And honestly, the more you print and the more you spend, the less it's worth. So they're seeing the devaluation of our dollar. They're seeing an economic fissure starting to take place, which could crack our economy apart. So I understand the desire of our state legislators for saying Congress can't keep its own house, so maybe it's time we rein them in, and by asking them to call a convention. And that convention, supposedly, according to the Ohio resolution, SJR 2, would require three things. These are the amendments Ohio's Republican senators who sponsored this resolution want to see. First, they want to see that there only be balanced budgets for all federal programs and agencies, so a balanced budget amendment. This is not the first time that calls have been made for a constitutional convention for balancing the budget. This has taken place in the 70s. This has taken place earlier. You hear about this coming back again and again and again. Oh, now, so that's the first. But Ohio's has three specific things they want. The first is balancing the budget. The second is what we call a line item veto. Currently, the United States president, when a bill is submitted to him for approval, has basically three actions he can take. He can either sign it and put it in, and then it goes into law. He can let it set for a number of days.
10 days.
10 days, and then it goes into law unless that 10-day window happens around the end of a legislative session, and that's called a pocket veto.
Right.
Or he can specifically veto the legislation, say, I do not approve of this, and I don't want this to become law, and then it goes back to the Congress, and then they have to get a 2/3 vote in each of the two chambers to override the presidential veto. These are some of the protections and the checks and balances that our founders put into Article 1 and Article 2 of our Constitution in order to make sure that you didn't have a Congress that could control the president through legislative fiat, and a president who couldn't necessarily just control the Congress by vetoing everything they sent to him without any possible hope of overturning it and overriding the will of an executive. So they want a balanced budget. They want a line item veto. They don't want the president, when a budget's sent to him or when a fiscal issue is sent to him. Right now, his only option is he has to veto the entire thing, regardless if there's constitutionally permissible budget items in it or not. They want a line item veto. They want the president to be able to say, okay, this budget item line here, okay, that's constitutional. I don't think they really care whether it's constitutional. They just hope that, this spending line item for the pork in my district gets okayed. This spending line item from the pork in the district of our political opponents gets vetoed.
And therein lies the rub, because basically everybody's in grabbing pork for their district so they can reelected. And they love these omnibus spending bills that everything in a telephone book size bill.
That's the crack cocaine of congressional politics, is omnibus appropriations measures.
And that way, basically with an omnibus spending bill, you don't have to worry about so-and-so in the district reading it and saying, hey, what's this all about? Basically, you say, oh, it was part of an omnibus spending bill. There wasn't anything I could say. If I'd been against it, we would have killed the whole budget, and then we would have had the government shut down.
And even if it is objectionable, they hide it in certain things called the Farm Bill or the Defense Appropriations Act.
How many times recently have gun control bills popped up in weird things?
In budget items.
Yeah, in budget items. And treaty issues popped up in budget items. A lot of times the farm bills and those kinds of things that nobody looks at.
The fact is, ladies and gentlemen, that's one of the log rolling measures that our politicians do, is that they can pack an unrelated bill with issues that by themselves, on their own, facially would not stand the light of day and couldn't be supported by enough members of Congress in order to get it through to make it a law, but they'll pack it into another bill that's vital to certain things, like continuing our farmers being able to farm, or allowing our troops to be able to have the weaponry and the defensive measures that they need when they're actually fighting constitutionally entered wars.
Allowing farmers to sell raw milk, which a federal judge has just ruled we have no right to any actual food stuff.
Well, we'll go into that. We want to talk about that one in a later program. But going back to this, let's say that this bill says that the president can veto only lines in a budget instead of the whole budget. Now, that sounds really good. I like that idea. You like that idea. Why Congress hasn't allowed that by voting it in the first place, I don't know. But we're going to explain to you as we go through this week why calling for a constitutional convention to add this amendment isn't anywhere near a good idea.
not even close. The best idea. It's probably the worst.
It's probably
idea.
One of the worst methods of doing this. Now, the Ohio resolution, Senate Joint Resolution 2, sponsored by Senator Coley, also has a third provision, a third amendment that they're asking for. And that is to require the president to submit to Congress and the Congress to adopt budgets on a biennial, that's every 2 year, rather than an annual basis. In other words, they don't want every year having to come back for reauthorizations. Now, Chuck, you and I have sat here and we've looked at this and we've come back and forth and saying, really, is it all that important to say we budget for 2 year cycles instead of 1 year cycles?
Well, it is if you're a state lawmaker and you're hoping for that big federal check.
Well, see, that's a point.
Deals with your biennial budget, because here in Ohio, we do budget issues every 2 years.
Yeah, that's right. And many states do biennial budgets, but the federal government does it annually. So when the states are trying to balance their budget on federal monies that they're getting in through various programs, grants, and line items in those federal budgets, if every year it's up for grabs, that's instability for the states. Now, my point is, the greatest instability is the states relying on anything coming from the feds to balance their state budgets in the first place.
Exactly. The revenue should never leave Ohio in the first place, and when it does, a whole bunch of it gets lost in administrative and costs for all these employees in Washington who have to take the money in and account for it and decide where it goes. And you've got basically thousands and thousands of administrators you have to pay, when in fact the money could have stayed here in the first place.
Right. And we'll talk later on in the week, probably toward the end of the week, about another piece of legislation that was introduced last session that we're hoping gets reintroduced this session that would actually get to what Chuck is talking about and probably would just eliminate the need for this third portion amendment in this resolution. But here we are. It's been introduced. It's a resolution, joint resolution, so it means it'll go to the House for them to agree to it as well. Well, it may go to the House if it isn't stopped in the Senate. And I'm going to tell you why during the week. Historically, from our Constitution, from our history of constitutional conventions, why we need to stop this piece of legislation from ever getting adopted. But right now, what it's going to do, it's going to call, based on Article 5 of the United States Constitution, call Congress to bring forth a constitutional convention. Now, Congress, once those 34 states make a call, and there's nothing in Article 5, and we'll discuss this tomorrow, there's nothing in Article 5 that specifically says that those calls all have to be about the same thing. So it could be calls on various amendments. But once 34 states get those and they're filed with the clerk of the House and the Senate and the Congress, Congress has no option. It's a shall, a directive word in Article 5. Congress shall call a convention for the purpose of amendments.
Yeah, exactly. And once the clerk actually, one of the problems in the past has been of people trying to get a constitutional convention called was the clerk wasn't really compiling the list.
Yes, that's
so that's been a good thing. But this time around, we don't know. Nobody ever knows if the clerk is compiling the list or not. So surprise, surprise, you may find yourself, if 34 states have passed one of these things in some kind of a constrained time period, voila, you may find yourself with a constitutional convention in your lap. And believe me, sort of like a 200-pound St. Bernard. You don't want him there. You may like the dog, but you don't want him in your lap.
That's right. Now, ladies and gentlemen, stay with us for tomorrow's episode of Principles and Policies, because we're going to start unpacking that even though our senators have put in what they think to be boundaries and limits, that these are actually not worth the paper they're written on or the ink that's used to write them, based upon Article 5 in our history. How do bad assumptions lead to catastrophic conclusions? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy, and along with me is our Vice Chairman, Chuck Michaelis.
Hi, I'm glad to be with you, and I'm glad we're discussing bad assumptions, because there's a lot of them out there.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, we've been talking, if you were with us yesterday, we were talking about a new piece of legislation that's been introduced in our Ohio State Senate by Senator Bill Coley, Senate Joint Resolution Number 2. SJR 2, as it would be known, is a resolution that would put Ohio on record as calling the Federal Congress of the United States to call an Article 5 constitutional convention for the purpose of amending the United States Constitution. However, as I said, wrong assumptions lead to catastrophic conclusions. And this piece of legislation, if you will, a resolution, it's only about 2 pages long, is filled with bad assumptions. That's the big problem. On the face of it, on the first page, basically it lays out some rationales, you know, that our country's in a mess, that we're more deeply in debt, and we're spending more than we're taking in, and that we need to take some steps to control our budget and eliminate our deficits. Okay, we all agree with that. I think everybody, right, left, and center, could agree with that, given what we see around us in the country. Then they move on, Senator Coley and his colleagues here, they move on to state that because Article 5 allows for states to request of Congress to call a convention to bring amendments that Congress on its own wouldn't pass. See, there are two. Now, Chuck, and this is why I'm glad Chuck's here today, because Chuck's our constitutional teacher, and he's really delved into this particular article of the U.S. Constitution deeply. And we'll try not to go so deep on you that it feels like you're drowning, because you can drown in all of the various twists and turns that go along with Article 5. But there are two methods for proposing amendments to the Constitution that our founders decided. And it's my understanding that this kind of was really a throwaway article. They really didn't take a whole lot of time discussing this, debating this. It was almost an afterthought that they threw this into the Constitution in the first place.
It's almost as if somebody said, you know, we really got to figure out a way to slip something in here so that if we have to call one of these again, one of these constitutional conventions again, there's a mechanism for doing it. Not a whole lot of work went into it. Honestly, if you read it, not a whole lot of thinking ahead went into it, because they did not foresee the fact that state sovereignty would be such a problem in the 21st century. Everybody assumed that state sovereignty would stay intact. There were those at the convention who wanted to eliminate state sovereignty, and unfortunately, they have, over the period of years, become the winners.
Now, you understand this because you've studied the notes on the debates of the convention that were kept by Madison.
Not just Madison, but
a number of the men who were there at the convention. And, you know, you can find those books, ladies and gentlemen, if you go out and you Google the stuff up. If you're really interested in reading into this, you can find out that what Chuck found out was they really didn't spend a whole lot of time on this. This was something, first of all, I think I want to give kudos to our founders in one sense, because they realized they weren't perfect. They realized that this document wasn't divinely inspired and holy writ, and therefore everything, once they closed the book after Article 4, that everything else was just perfectly fine. And so,
that's right.
And they, when they got down to the end of it, and actually there are 7 articles in the Constitution, but when they got down to the end of it, they realized that maybe we need to have some flexibility in case something comes up that we have to address that we didn't foresee.
That's right. And like we said last week, biblically based is not divinely inspired.
That's true. That's true. So we don't want to make that, don't want that to be confused. So what they did was they crafted this little article, and it allows for two mechanisms for amending the Constitution. One is amendments directly proposed by the Congress itself, the lawmaking body who has all the legislative authority granted in the Constitution through Article 1. The second, and this is what we talked about a little bit yesterday, is that the states themselves, through their legislatures, can make application to the Congress, and once two-thirds of the states, or 34 of the 50 states now, make an application to the Congress through the resolution process, which SJR 2 is part of that, then Congress is bound. They must call for a constitutional convention to discuss the requested amendments.
Well, actually, and therein lies the first bad assumption.
And I made it.
Yeah, well, you didn't really, but it's based on the language in the Constitution, and a lot of people make the assumption that because of this language, which says, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, the Congress shall call a convention for proposing amendments which, in either case, shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states or by the conventions in three-fourths thereof. Now, if you listen to that language very carefully, it makes it sound like you can call a convention and limit it to only discussing amendments.
That's what, facially, that's what it sounds like. Now, we talked about ratification there and what Chuck read, but we're going to talk about ratification a little bit later because that's the other ghost in the room right now in dealing with this issue. But you're right. It sounds like it's talking about dealing with amendments. And ladies and gentlemen, historically speaking, after the first convention, which gave us the Constitution in 1787, we've never had another constitutional convention. We've never had one of these called since the first one. So we're really, when you're looking at historical precedent, what we must go back to is what happened during the first convention.
And that's right.
Chuck, I think you're going to unpack for people that what happened during the first convention shouldn't give us a lot of comfort level that any restrictions as to what amendments might be allowed to be heard in a new convention would be valid.
Well, essentially what happened was 11 of 12 attending states wrote quote-unquote strongly worded resolutions that called for the amendment of the Articles of Confederation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because the Articles of Confederation, ladies and gentlemen, up and through 1787, were the governing documents of our country. After the Revolution, the Articles of Confederation were put together so that those 13 colonies could work together, trade together, do various things as a nation of sovereign states. That's why it was called Articles of Confederation. They were being confederate with each other, but holding on to their sovereign identities as each state.
Right, and the reason that Congress is called a Congress is because Webster's 1828 dictionary definition of a Congress is a meeting of special deputies from sovereign states.
So, yes, that's something we've lost over the last couple of hundred years, but going back to Article 5, so right now, once those two-thirds of the states, and Ohio being one of them with SJR 2 setting out here, if Ohio passes SJR 2, it adds itself to the number, and when we reach 34 states have called,
34,
Congress is bound. The word is shall. It's not a permissive piece of language. It is a directive piece of language. Congress has no option other than to call for a convention.
Well, I think we need to cap off that point that for instance, the first constitutional convention was called for the purpose of amending the Articles of Confederation.
That's true.
There is absolutely no doubt about all the resolutions were very clear except for one, and I think that was New Hampshire, that what was supposed to happen was the Articles of Confederation was supposed to be amended, and everybody thought the part that was going to be amended was the Interstate Commerce Clause.
Which was the problem at the time.
Yeah, the Articles didn't have one.
That was the crisis of the day. Just like today, SJR 2 is stating that the crisis is,
our budgets are out of balance and we've got excess spending and runaway deficits. So going back to that original, so once that was called and it was brought together and that constitutional convention was put forth, what happened?
Well, the very first act of the constitutional convention was to vote to operate in secret.
Okay. And they didn't want snooty reporters going out there trying to spin what they were doing ahead of time.
And that's essentially it. They didn't want word to get out what they were doing. But the second thing they did was they voted on a series of resolutions that said, okay, the Articles of Confederation is dead.
Okay, but wait a minute. The Articles of Confederation was the governing document. Is that correct?
Yes. That was the current operating highest law of the land.
And so when they got in there, they started voting, and what they basically did was they killed the Articles of Confederation.
They voted to chuck the Articles of Confederation as the governing document of the United States.
Well, was that part of the New Hampshire resolution? Is that the reason why you said it was a little different than the others?
Well, New Hampshire's basically gave their delegates a kind of a free hand.
Well, I guess they must have taken it.
They took a real free hand.
And they really influenced a lot of other delegates. Because if it's my remembrance, because I've seen some of those original resolutions, they were very specific in saying you can only discuss these issues and no others.
At least four states. Maryland being having probably the strongest worded resolution saying amendments regarding certain things and not others, and the exact certain things kind of slipped my mind, but we'll look that up.
Well, and you know, if anybody wants to give us a call or drop us an email at principledpolicy.com.
We've written documents that have it all laid out, so
that's right.
Look
well,
on our website.
Well, the reason why I bring that up, Chuck, is because it sounds very familiar, because as I'm looking at Senate Joint Resolution 2 here, the Ohio Constitutional Convention call document, it basically says here, as a resolved, you know, big capital letters, resolved. It means it's firm. We're firm on this. As a state legislature, we're firm on this. Resolved that if the convention called by the Congress is not limited in subject to the amendment proposed in this resolution, i.e., and we talked about that yesterday, there's three parts to it. Basically, a balanced budget, a line item veto, and every 2 year budgeting instead of annual budgeting. So, if it's not limited to that subject that's proposed in this resolution in SJR 2, any delegates, representatives, or participants from the state of Ohio asked to participate in the convention are permitted to debate and vote only on the proposed amendment contained within this resolution or an equivalent amendment. Sounds to me like our state senators are thinking, okay, well, we're going to lock them down. Didn't the state legislatures back during the 1787 period think that that's what they were doing too?
Exactly. That's exactly what they thought they were doing. And it's because there were a whole lot of people who don't understand the basic nature of a convention on a national level.
And we're going to talk about that more in detail tomorrow. But what I want to get to today, because I think we're kind of getting close to the end of our time here, is the fact that this portion of SJR 2 that says we're going to bind the delegates, they don't have any basis in Article 5 to stand on this claim. There's nothing in Article 5 that says that the state legislature, number one, will even be allowed to pick the delegates, and number two, if so picked, that doesn't say whether they would be allowed or not allowed to just direct the delegates how they are to vote.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. There is absolutely no reason to believe that the states will even be allowed to choose delegates.
And I think maybe subconsciously, Senator Coley understands this, because he said any delegates, representatives, or participants that are asked to participate in the convention. So under this portion of the resolution, he's assuming that Congress is going to then be making the call, and those are going to be, or maybe he's saying that the state legislature is asking, because maybe he's assuming too much that the legislature, because they issued the request to Congress, then that binds Congress to force them to allow the states to pick their delegates.
No such binding.
It's not in there.
It ain't in there.
Just as he said, like ragu and the other sauces. It isn't in
there.
That's
right. Where's the beef?
Where's the beef? It isn't in there.
That's right. And the fact is, because it's not in there and it's not specifically laid out, under the current political atmosphere, it defaults to the federal government.
Okay. And ladies and gentlemen, we're probably going to have to wrap up here. But the point is, we're getting to an interesting concept, and that is, when we're dealing with the Constitution, silence does not equal assent. Just because if the Constitution is silent to a provision, doesn't mean that you can assume that you're allowed to do it. Our Constitution may be hanging by a thread that our state legislators hold a scissor to. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, Executive Director of the Institute for Principle and Policy. And with me today is Chuck Michaels, my Vice Chairman, Technical Wizard, and Constitutional Teacher. Thanks for being here, Chuck.
And thank you for having me, and thank you for inviting us into your cars, homes, or wherever.
And hopefully that wherever is someplace safe where they're not trying to do this while operating heavy machinery, because hopefully we're not putting anybody to sleep.
That's
out
right.
There. I know this is sometimes a dry subject, because what we're talking about is the operation of our Constitution and how the federal government's power and the state government's power interact, specifically in this area of the call for an Article 5 Constitutional Convention. Senate Joint Resolution 2 is the issue that we've got before us right now. We've talked about it earlier this week. A couple of things we haven't talked about. One of the things that this resolution does is that it makes a paragraph in it says, resolved that if 2/3 of the legislatures of the several states make application to the Congress to call a constitutional convention, which is the standard under Article 5 for the number, so 34 states. So when 34 states make that call, the state of Ohio requests that such a convention be called not later than 6 months after the Congress receives the 34th application from a state legislature. Now, you and I discussed this offline here the other day, and that really sets up a real issue with Article 6 and the Supremacy Clause.
Well, that's right, because this is a legitimate, as opposed to many illegitimate that we mentioned yesterday, this is a legitimate Article 6 issue, and that's the Supremacy Clause. And in fact, the state legislatures have no power to bind the federal legislature.
Right. Now, and again, and I understand that the pushback will be, well, we're just requesting them to do so. However, if Congress would cede to that request and then dial up a convention inside of 6 months from the last call being made and actually have it convene within 6 months, we're going to have a situation where probably not a lot of thought is going to go into, from either end, whether it be from Congress or from the states, delegate selection.
Oh, I have an idea that those who have been agitating for a constitutional convention already have a great big list and a great big set of criteria already set up. Here's I would just about guarantee a federal list would include judges, law professors, constitutional scholars, quote unquote, and I really have minor respect in many cases. I hate to say that. That's not a good thing, but I have minor respect for a lot of people touted as constitutional scholars, because they automatically adopt, in 99% of the cases, they automatically adopt a living document stance. So let's see, who else? There will be a certain number of seats that will be for organized labor. There will be a certain number of seats for minorities. There will be a certain number of seats that will be required for very specialized, handicapped or, those kind of things. There will be a list of criteria that someone will have worked out. And the fact is that the states really have no power to bind and would be bound, unfortunately, because of the lack of knowledge, because of the lack of language in Article 5, would be bound to what the federals decided they had to do.
Yes, because if Congress passes a resolution of their own or an actual bill that spells out the standards for delegates, including the number of delegates each state may send to a convention, and there's no guarantee that that will be equal to their congressional representation. There won't be any guarantees at all as to whether or not certain states will get multiple individuals who can come to a convention, and other states may only get one. There's also nothing in Article 5 that speaks to how many votes each state will get in convention. Now, we know with the original 1787 convention, each state had one vote. Right. They could send a number of delegates. Some states sent three. Some states sent half a dozen.
It was based on population.
It was based more on population.
But not necessarily. I mean, basically, the state legislatures were allowed to send a certain number. But it didn't matter because if they sent one guy, if they sent 12, they got one vote in the convention. Mm-hmm. Except in committee things, they got to vote. There were different rules.
There were numerous committees.
It's too complex to go into. But
ultimately, at the end of the day, when the vote came on the final document.
The final document.
Each colony was allotted
one state, one vote.
And so... But you know what? As you just said,
and they had to have a quorum of their delegates.
Yes, they did. You couldn't just have, well, let's say if you had three delegates, if only one was there, that didn't constitute a quorum, so you couldn't vote. And that's what happened in New York.
In New York.
Because Alexander Hamilton was there, but the other two delegates, which the governor had handpicked because.
Well, the legislature picked them.
The legislature picked. Well, the governor had a play in that as well. But the point is, the other two delegates had left.
Yep.
So until,
they went home.
But they finally got them to come back, and...
No, actually, they didn't.
Oh, that's true.
Yates and Lansing abandoned the convention in July. Alexander Hamilton actually abandoned it in June and came back and did committee work, but was not allowed to vote on the final product.
That's true. I forgot about that. But the thing that raised the thought to me, as you said it, was that there's nothing in Article 5, because it's dead silent, to keep Congress from making the first requirement for delegates to be that they're sitting congressmen.
Oh, absolutely nothing.
Because if you were looking at proportional representation, that's what Congress is. Each state's allotted so many congresspeople by virtue of their population in their state. So we could end up with a situation, because Article 5 doesn't specify, that these people cannot also be the elected officials. So, you know, where does that put us at that point? Then those officials can determine how everything gets structured.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And again, this is why, because conventions are so powerful by their nature, and this is one of the things we're running into, is we're getting opposition on from people telling us, no, no, no. One of the first things you'll hear on a radio talk show is that someone will call in and say, well, I'm not talking about a national convention, a full-blown change
of the Constitution.
We're just talking about an amendment convention, as mentioned in Article 5. And I'm like,
they're the same thing.
Category error. They are the same thing.
It's exactly the same.
There is no such thing as a convention limited to an amendment. Once you empower one, the control of the convention is in the hands of the delegates, and they can do anything they want. Now, are they completely empowered to change the system? No.
Well, that one is a qualified no.
That's right.
Because if you remember, the original delegates to the 1787 convention were not empowered to totally change the system either. However, that's exactly what they did.
That's exactly what they did. And if you've ever, as Barry and I have just been involved in a research project to... look at the various Federalist and Anti-Federalist writings and speeches and those kinds of things. The debate was rather rancorous, and one of the main tripping points was the fact that the federal government was being given too much power, and there was no Bill of Rights in it.
That's right, and that led to, as you know, later on, we ended up with a Bill of Rights.
That's right.
After the Constitution had been ratified by the states under a ratification procedure that was in the document to be ratified.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. The old Articles of Confederation, which were the highest law of the land at the time.
They're right. That was the governing document.
That was the governing document. The legislators were bound. And the states had agreed by contract to obey its tenets. And what came out of that, basically there was an article called Article 13.
Mm-hmm.
And Article 13 required that if any changes were to be made to the Articles of Confederation, that all 13 states had to agree and had to be with unanimous consent. Okay, so knowing full well that they weren't going to get unanimous consent, after we've discussed this, I think, on Monday, we talked about the fact that the first thing, the first act was to toss out, was to operate in secret.
The first vote was after the convention was convened and the president of the convention was picked, who was right. George Washington.
That's right.
The first vote was that all deliberations were to be done in absolute secrecy.
Absolute secret. Then the next set of things they did was decide that we're going to throw out the Articles of Confederation. Well, they knew full well, since only 12 states showed up, Rhode Island didn't bother to send delegates because they didn't want to play, and they were always the troublemaker.
Good for them.
The delegates knew they were not going to get unanimous consent. So what they did was they rigged up this mechanism whereby the new Constitution would be ratified by an entirely separate procedure. And that procedure was 3/4 of the states, of the existing states,
mm-hmm.
out of 13, which was nine.
If
a minimum of 9 states ratified, that meant the old Articles of Confederation passed away and the Constitution took effect. Now, here's the problem. You've got law sitting there, and it's existing law, and they didn't change it.
That's right.
They bypassed it.
They totally bypassed it.
Now, why can they do that? Let me ask you a question after this talk on conventions.
Certainly.
And the power of conventions. Why were they able to do that?
Because a convention is the highest lawmaking body in the land, and they have plenipotentiary power to change the form of government.
That's right. All conventions are, by their nature, what is called plenipotentiary. In other words, they have all power. They are the highest governing body in what's called the body politic.
That's right.
And the body politic is all men, women, and children who live in a geographic region.
A jurisdiction.
That's a specific jurisdiction.
That's correct. And so, that, ladies and gentlemen, that's the big concern. Right now, our legislators, including Senator Coley, and I certainly am going to have some talks with him about this, are going under a bad assumption based on silence. And their bad assumption based on silence is that anything that comes out of a convention that they may call with this Article 5 call will be bound by the existing U.S. Constitution's Article 5 requirements.
That's right.
And there's absolutely nothing to hold that to, considering we have the example, we have the precedent. Remember, we base all of our law now on precedent. We have the precedent of our original convention doing exactly the opposite of what our current state legislators are assuming is going to be the case. You see, they're assuming that, well, number one, we can bind our delegates, and number two, everybody's going to operate by the rules we're living under right now. That didn't happen then, and given our environment, I don't think it's a certainty that it will happen now.
No, and in fact, basically, all the assumptions are really just incredibly bad. And unfortunately, they were also bad in a lot of cases in 1787.
Well, that's true.
A lot of people did not understand the procedure. And in fact, a lot of the same kind of nonsense was used. The same kind of crisis type thinking was used to get the first Constitutional Convention.
That's right. And that original crisis was
Shays' Rebellion.
Shays' Rebellion. That's
Shays'
right.
Rebellion, essentially. We will not go into this history. If you want a history of this, Camp American did a... I did a 2-hour presentation at Camp American on the history of how we got the first Constitutional Convention, and it's a doozy. And frankly, I think everybody would be well placed to go out to www.campamerican.com and purchase a copy of this. It's 2-hour long video. It's two DVDs, and avail yourselves of the history of it, because it's actually kind of fascinating.
Absolutely. You know, that's the other thing you bring up, Jay. As we're talking about these issues, many things that we're talking about, folks can go to our website
at
principledpolicy.com. or campamerican.com
and
find many of these resources, find these materials. You can even find a briefing paper we did. If you go and you look and you Google up Constitutional Convention or Article 5, you'll find a policy bulletin that we did on Constitutional Conventions, Crises, and Coups, our position on the calling of a new Constitutional Convention, some of which we've been talking about this week. Now, tomorrow we're going to be discussing, wrapping up on this issue and discussing why we need to have you contact your state legislator to educate them on why this is a bad idea. Give us 2 minutes and you may save your liberty. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to this week-ending edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And with me, as usual, is my sidekick colleague, friend and mentor in the Constitution, Chuck Michaels.
And as always, I'm ready to go.
All right. Excellent. Excellent. All right. We've been talking about Senate Joint Resolution 2. Now, I want to make one thing clear here on our wrap-up here. All of the people who have put their names upon this particular piece of legislation, including the sponsor, Bill Coley, and including local state senator Tim Schaefer, have done so because they believe that our country is in an economic crisis. And many of them, I believe there's no way we can get Congress to do the things that should be they are responsible for doing in the first place to solve the crisis.
The one thing that has to be remembered, a historical lesson that we should learn here, and is that both sides of this issue should know that the only way to get fundamental changes done is by the manipulation of crisis. Now, crisis is unavoidable in any kind of government endeavor. In fact, that's basically sort of what governments are there to handle.
Oh, isn't that kind of a working definition of what government is?
I would think so. Yeah, the problem is that what happens is certain crises are looked for by individuals who are attempting to implement certain kinds of changes, and they will manipulate these crises and make them into something they are not. And that's why we brought up Shays' Rebellion in the last show, because that wasn't what it really looks like, and a lot of the history books are wrong. And again, we're not going to go into that. But it was very successfully manipulated to get us from the old Articles of Confederation into the new Constitution. And really all that needed to be done to the old Articles, in most people's view, was to fix the Interstate Commerce Clause. The mess we've ended up with the Interstate Commerce Clause in our present Constitution, because of a deliberate manipulation of that, is simply amazing. But, again, that's not what we're going for today.
No.
Just remember that all crises are manipulable into something that they aren't.
And when you're dealing with folks who are creating crises such as Occupy Wall Street, such as a banking meltdown, such as other things that have had a lot of outside help
historically,
to get going.
Historically, many revolutions have been fought in two or three cities of a country. Everybody else seems relatively peaceful and not much going on. In fact, in Russia, it was fought in St. Petersburg and Moscow and maybe a Black Sea port, Sevastopol, or one of the Black Sea ports. That was it. An entire country changed governmental hands because somebody seized St. Petersburg.
Right, exactly. So we have to be careful here because, right now we're in a situation where we have an economic situation. We have unrest going on. We have external pressures from foreign countries. We're in the midst of what could turn out to be a rather rancorous presidential election season.
It will be.
It will be. Okay. Well, that's fine. I was trying to give out a little bit of hope.
You're being diplomatic.
Yeah. I have a little bit more of an optimistic eschatology when it comes to these kind of things. But the whole point is that, folks, you put all this together in the crucible. And then you throw in somebody who's got a good heart but doesn't understand the history, making a official call through a joint resolution, Senate Joint Resolution 2, to call for a constitutional convention in this country at this time. Basically what you've done is you've just handed a lever to those folks who, if they really think that our Constitution is outdated and outmoded, that we really have a living Constitution which needs to change with the times. If we're, if, as we've heard our president even say, I wish I didn't have to deal with Congress.
Yes.
Or had Congress people say how, oh, the Constitution really doesn't matter to us. And there have been sitting Congress people who've publicly said that.
Well, Pete Stark has said not the equivalent, but this is a direct paraphrase. He said there are no restrictions on the federal government. Nothing. None at all.
Not at all. Although Article 1, Section 8 is still sitting out there and is still the governing document.
Well, let's talk about this because
basically
one of the things, crises can always be manipulated and they always are. Now, what's going on? Let's have a look at what could happen with Occupy Wall Street. It suddenly turns into things where there are open riots in the cities and that kind of thing. We've already had a sitting governor talking in terms of let's suspend elections.
To deal with the economic issue. Now, that was the governor of North Carolina. That happened here just probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Now, of course, her handlers tried to poo-poo that off. She was joking or she was being sarcastic. But the more reporters and investigators started digging into it, the more they realized she was dead serious. And it was actually part of the message she was trying to get across in the speech she was giving.
And that's the way it works. So people throw up trial balloons.
That's right. They wanted to see what kind of response they were going to get out of it.
And the way you get good people to come out and be in favor of things like a constitutional convention is you take them into places where there are people that they trust who tell them, who feed them bad history and bad reasoning. And by that, I think we should be open about what we're talking about. We're talking about the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is known as ALEC, and the Goldwater Institute, both of which have a reputation as conservative think tanks.
Neither of which the vast majority of people in our listening audience or in general in the population know anything about.
That's
because
right.
These are what you call the associations and the clubs, ladies and gentlemen.
That's right.
ALEC is a group, supposedly conservative legislators. They've met for years. They gather them together 2 or 3 times a year in nice locales, like on the beach or somewhere, or at nice hotels. And they talk to him about how wonderful it would be if you just take these models of legislation and take them back to your states and pass them so that we can get all these wonderful things.
And admittedly, ALEC has put out some pretty decent stuff in the past.
They've put out some decent stuff, but on this issue,
they're way off. Their
ear is a little tin because they're listening to the Goldwater Institute. Now, we bring this up because everybody remember. I'm sure some people in our listening audience remember Barry Goldwater and his 1964 presidential campaign. And, you know, that whole idea, that conservative movement that really kind of blossomed and took shape around Goldwater. Well, the big problem is that just as Goldwater moderated and became, well, liberal in his older age, seems like that's what the Goldwater Institute's doing as well. They're sending out, quote unquote, constitutional experts to go to state legislatures to create presentations about how wonderful it is and how it's necessary for us to have a new constitutional convention. Well, Mr. Michaelis, again, I said that he's my constitutional mentor. He is that because he's not afraid to get his hands dirty. He's not afraid to do the hard work. He's also not afraid to hear somebody say something and say, wonder where they came up with that idea. Let me go dig and figure out what their sources were. And he's done just that. Chuck spent an awful lot of time putting together our policy bulletin for the Institute of Principled Policy on constitutional conventions, crises, and coups. What he did was we heard presentations and papers that were written by the quote-unquote a law professor from the University of Montana, who the Goldwater Institute has hired, or he's an adjunct at, to go around to the states to convince them to pass these resolutions calling for a constitutional convention. And, he lays out his scholarship, and, of course, he has a string of letters behind his name. And so, therefore, a lot of those legislators look at him and say, well, he must be an expert. There's that myth of the professional,
ladies and gentlemen. It's a cult of the professional.
Cult of the professional. But the point is that Mr. Michaelis took his bibliography, found the books and the thinkers that he was reading, and went and found copies. See, that's the beautiful part about the web and places like Amazon and Google Books and other places.
You can find books that are way out of print for a long, long time, which I did. I have to give kudos to my wife. who bought me a Kindle for Christmas. And let me tell you, I figured out how to download books from Google Books and convert them to Kindle format. And I've got books that I've been looking for 5, 10 years. I got them for free.
That are now accessible. But what he did was he went back to these original thinkers. We went to Blackstone, went to St. George Tucker and his notes. John Randolph Tucker and their notes on the Constitution.
John Taylor of Caroline.
That's right. People who were part of the original convention. Legal scholars and thinkers who were writing commentaries on the Constitution itself and on the and I'm looking at a set of books called The Founders' Constitution that Mr. Michaelis has on his bookshelf. We're here in the vast, spacious library of the Michaelis domain today recording. And, you know, that's the whole point. I'm seeing, like, vast numbers of resources here, books that he has studied. Because this issue is that important, ladies and gentlemen, it's worth spending the time to understand. But what he discovered was these scholars that are going around the country telling legislators how wonderful it would be to call for a new convention are cherry-picking their sources and taking things out of context from other thinkers to make their case.
Honestly, I was appalled at some of the, for instance, you and I happened to find a copy of a book called Constitutional Brinksmanship that was heavily quoted. And I went through and read the book, and I actually bought two copies of them because, and here's a
good
reason.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's right. I gave one to Barry for his birthday. It's a $90 book that I happened to find in a used book place that had a stack of them for a dollar a piece. Well, that's a kind of a rare find, so I hurried up and bought it. But he and I both read it, and we both came to the same. I said, you need to read this to see if I'm completely off base. And I read the book.
And he didn't tell me what his conclusion was before I read it and told him what my conclusion was.
And we both concluded the same thing, that basically what the Goldwater Institute fellow, this constitutional expert, said, this book said, the book did not say.
Said exactly the opposite.
Said the opposite. In fact, he said it basically that this scholar who had worked in the Justice Department was in support of the ability to call a controlled convention. And in fact, the guy said, no, that's not what you can do. And he went through the historical precedents for it, why it couldn't be done.
Exactly. Now, but the whole point is that we have boiled this down into a policy paper that's about 10 or 12 pages long. It's a small booklet. And we would like to get a copy into your hands. Now, if you want to go online and download it and print it for yourself, it'll print out as just regular sheet. Or you can contact us at principalpolicy.com and go in and fill out in the comment boxes, and we can send you a copy of this bulletin for you to read for yourself. We are also giving this bulletin to every member of the Ohio General Assembly, starting with the co-sponsors on Senate Joint Resolution 2, then with the members of the Senate Finance Committee to which the bill has been assigned, then to the full Senate, then to the House of Representatives. We want them to understand that there is better scholarship out there because we actually read in context and we understand and read the history of our current governing document. The reason why we're so concerned about this, ladies and gentlemen, is just as in 1787, we have no guarantee that what the convention, if called, comes out with will have any relationship to our current form of government or be ratified in the same way. It could be by a plebiscite. It could be by national popular vote. It could just be by executive order, depending on how this is set up. We have no guarantees, ladies and gentlemen, that we the people or the states or state conventions could have any say in putting anything together that could totally radically change our form of government.
Well, we know that there are already constitutional models out there that do bypass the ratification procedure.
Yes.
And in fact, they go to a direct plebiscite.
Ones that have been funded by major philanthropies and have been... Ford Foundation and others who have put millions of dollars into the development of these documents. And again, it's because we've done the research and we've gone and we've found these materials which have been kept from public view for a very long time, that we're able to put this together to make that presentation. Now, what we're asking you to do is visit our website at principledpolicy.com, click on the link to contact your state senators and your state representatives, and to share with them your concerns about why it's not a good idea to have Ohio on record as calling for a constitutional convention. There was another issue in this resolution about trying to bind future legislators in the next sessions, because they call it a continuing application.
Maybe we better stretch that into the Saturday show.
Yeah, maybe we'll talk a little bit more about this tomorrow on our Saturday program. But please visit the website. Please contact your state legislator, your state senator. Be kind, be reasonable, be gentle, because they are really dealing with a lack of information.
That's right.
And we want to make sure that they understand it from a constitutional viewpoint. Thank you for being with us. This is Principles and Policies, signing off.